Doc Leipzig, the oldest festival for animation and documentary in the world, is happening in a hybrid format in 2020. We're embracing the opportunities that come along with it. Welcome to the new Doc Industry Program podcast, realized in collaboration with What's Up with Docs, the Programmers of Color Collective, and independent film industry curator Temba Bebe. Welcome to a series of discussions on subjects such as story sovereignty, diversity and inclusion in the documentary industry, and decolonizing our industry in general. These podcasts are funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, the BKM, and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contributions. Enjoy.
All right. We are going to go ahead and start this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Shakira Rifos, and today's topic is about who is missing from the coming of age narrative. I was brought to this conversation by the Programmers of Color Collective. Lucy Mukherjee introduced us to this conversation, and I'm really grateful that she put trust in me and my friends to talk to you all about racism, about whiteness, and about film. The first thing I'm going to do is introduce myself. I'll read my biography, and then I'm going to introduce my distinguished guests for today, and they'll do a little bit of chatting about themselves as well. I'm going to read this in third person, so that's kind of weird, but I think it's fine. Shakira is an educator from the Netherlands who joined the California Film Institute's education department by way of the Sarasota Film Festival and Sundance Film Institute. Her career has been dedicated to empowering young independent thinkers through the exploration of art history and creative expression, prioritizing equitable praxis through engagements with film, as well as demystifying the path for BIPOC students to becoming Film Fest administrators. So that's Black and Indigenous people of color, BIPOC students. With a deep passion for storytelling, Shakira attributes her drive for community, justice, and common sense from the cultures of her mother and her father, hailing from Trinidad and Suriname, respectively. All right, so that's a little bit about me. Let's talk to Celeste Wong. Celeste was born and raised in California, the Bay Area, has worked for local theater and film organizations for the last 6 years, and is currently the programming associate with the Mill Valley Film Festival. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Happy to be here talking to you.
Good. Can you let the audience know kind of what you're up to? Your bio says that you are the programming associate with the Mill Valley Film Festival. We're colleagues and we work together. What's life like in Mill Valley for you right now?
We are deep in it right now, as you know. So this is my third year with the festival. And this year is the first year that we are, of course, going online, going virtual for most of the festival. So it's been an enormous adjustment, but it's really exciting right now because we are opening soon and it's actually happening and it's real. So deep in it, but also very excited.
Good. Happy festival, Celeste.
Happy festival, Shakira.
Thank you for joining us. Nathan Murthy has a lifelong love of movies. He wrote his first cartoon series in elementary school and found his creative outlet for screenwriting in college. Outside his day job in tech, Nathan has managed to keep his dreams alive as a filmmaker. Originally from Houston, Texas, Nathan has spent half his life in the Bay Area, where he received his BA and BSc from UC Berkeley. He is also the organizer of the Fruitvale Short Film Series in Oakland, California, where he currently lives. Nathan, how are you doing today?
So, Shakira, I'm doing very well. So happy to be joining with you. What's cracking?
Yeah, I'm so happy that you're here. I always enjoy talking to you. What's going on with the Fruitvale Short Film Series in times of COVID?
Yeah, so we actually just wrapped it up. The Fruitvale Short Film Series we usually hold around fall, and we did it end of September this year. This year we raised about $2,000 for the Fremont High School Media Academy, which is a high school in Oakland Unified School District. And some of the students from the Media Academy actually have their films in the film series, which is actually how I found out about it. It was through a filmmaker that graduated from the Media Academy. So the main premise, the whole idea behind the film festival, behind the film series, is to really shed light on Black Indigenous POC filmmakers in the Bay Area, and create like a venue for them to represent their communities, and at the same time, like, give back to the communities and to like potential filmmakers who are out there. So it went well. I thought it went great. We raised 3 times more than what we raised last year. So I was really happy for that. And outside that film series, I also have a film of mine that is in the festival circuit right now. It was at SF Black Film Festival, Greater Cleveland Urban Film Festival, and it's currently at LA, Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival. A film that I shot last year and has been going through the circuits. So that's where I'm at right now.
What's the name of the film?
It's called Finals. Finals is the name of the film.
Perfect. Thank you. And you can find Nate on Instagram at Nate Murthy. That's at NateMurthy if you want to know a little bit more. All right, y'all, let's get started here. Who is missing from the coming of age narrative? So I'm gonna introduce the topic of conversation. I'm gonna read some of the resources that I came across while researching, my own personal thoughts. And then I'm gonna ask you all some questions about your experiences, and we'll just kind of like have a bit of a conversation here. So when I was asked to put something together for this festival, I'm always, as an educator, thinking about the population that I serve, which is students. And in prioritizing Black kids in my work, I'm always struggling to find the same precious films for their age range in which they can see their everyday struggles reflected as teenagers outside of living under whiteness. So I find this conversation extremely urgent. There's a lot to discuss, but we're gonna kind of try to pinpoint it and talk about the film festival industry. As an educator focused primarily on film analysis in California's Bay Area, I find I have a specific responsibility to prioritize Black students and students of color through my work and the platform that is provided to me by the California Film Institute, where I work full time. So let's real briefly just break down. When I say coming of age story, I'd like to lean into a section of Lenita Shannon's Deconstructing the Black Coming of Age Film and Its Effect on the Negotiation of Black Identity. Start of the quote, "Documenting the reality of a people can be done with fiction or nonfiction films. Though all youth go through a stage where they experience an event or series of events that marks a new phase in their lives or signifies that they are about to embark on a new journey. The Black coming-of-age film represents the power of fictional film to contextualize the existent social situations of youth in Black communities," end quote. So we're gonna be talking about fiction, and I will also be touching on documentaries. The white experience and growing up in a white world isn't a commonly relatable way of understanding coming into adulthood for students of color for many different reasons. That topic could be like an entire podcast in itself. But I wanna focus on the role of film festivals in this problem relating to docs and fiction. In my effort to find content that young Black students and students of color can truly relate to, I often come up short, especially when relying on the catalogs of the major film festivals that we know. I'm gonna read a little bit of Hollywood's coming of age stories remain white as hell. It's like Hollywood can't fathom a story about non-white kids. I'm gonna repeat that title because I think it's really funny. Hollywood's coming of age stories remain white as hell. It's like Hollywood can't fathom a story about non-white kids. And this was part of a piece written by Trishna Rickey. Start of the quote. "The fact is, white films just aren't doing it anymore. There is nothing about a white fictional character's life that grabs and holds my attention as a viewer who is not white. Growing up as a youth of color is a fundamentally different experience than growing up as a white teenager. While white experiences in coming of age films may touch on areas of similarity to our own lives, they are at their core different experiences simply because the white teens growing up do not experience the same marginalization as the teens of color. This does not mean that white-centric teen films can't be relatable and enjoyable to people of color. It just means that the goal of the genre to reach out to the audience lacks achievement when it comes to a non-white audience. Directors and producers seem to be under the impression that for a coming-of-age movie to feature a lead of color, the lead must undergo some type of hardship directly related to their race, whether it be poverty, racism, or anything else of the sort. It may be hard to believe, but teens of color are in fact capable of leading lives just as ordinary, just as comedically, romantically, familiarly based as white teens, end quote. So with this conversation, I'm not saying that growing up white and being protected by whiteness is equal to your experience being uneventful. Adolescence is inherently violent and at times humiliating and filled with cringy growing pains. I sometimes think of something I did in middle school and have like, an intrusive cringy moment. that's how deep these experiences go. Discovering and exploring our sexuality, coming into personhood, moving closer towards a kind of liberation that we start to experience as adults. Seeing these experiences featured on screen helps to make those real life experiences relatable for young people. Film as a tool for social change is a place young people should be able to go to foster creativity and confidence in their developing brains. Films help young people create a sense of empathy and identity. Lack of opportunity in seeing ourselves in stories or being in control of our own narratives have real life and harmful consequences. So I want to be specific about the two issues that we're going to highlight in this podcast, and then we're going to get into the conversation with Celeste and Nathan. So issue number one is when subjects or characters of color take a backseat to white protagonists, are erased, or are described to an audience from a white lens. In these cases, their depictions are commonly rooted in toxic stereotypes, a basis that is then often skewed, racially biased, or simply misinformed representation. The second issue is basing the Black or a person of color subject or character entire identity through racially induced trauma. So often meaning their marginalization is depicted through issues of poverty, state-sanctioned violence, police violence, and grief. I want to take this opportunity to investigate these issues and the role that our industry plays in it in the most candid way possible. The best way I do this is to invite two people I respect and really enjoy talking to when I have the opportunity. I personally talk about whiteness in the Institute a lot. As part of my work and just part of like who I am as a person, part of everything that led me to be where I am in life. And when I say the Institute, I don't mean one specific institute, although I will call out any organization that offends me at any time. But I admire both Celeste and Nathan for their ability to get to the bottom of these issues, explore it earnestly and with humility and with the respect that these conversations deserve. I think Americans often have a habit of talking around issues of race and racism without ever actually saying anything, or most importantly, ever admitting anything. But I find myself always being really satisfied after chatting with Celeste and Nathan, and I'm confident that the audience will walk away feeling similarly. All right, that was my monologue. Let's get to Nathan first. Nathan, in your short films, you tend to lean into people's presumptions and biases about young Black men and Black culture. I'd like to know, I enjoy the shorts that I've seen of yours so much. There's always just such an inherent, like, not really a surprise ending, but like a surprise feeling that I walk away with and having watched two of your shorts. Can you talk about this theme? Do you seek to explore this? Are you working on educating and teaching your audience a lesson, or is this part of who you are as a filmmaker?
And thank you for those words, and of course for having me on here to have this conversation. Short answer is yes to all of those. You know, it's when I think about, so the character in my film, maybe I should chat about him a little bit. So in the film, Finals, the main character, TJ, he's a Black student attending an elite university. We actually shot it on the UC Berkeley campus. And in the story, TJ has, like, you know, he's immersed in this world, this universe that he's in, of being on a college student on campus. But then he also has, like, this life that preceded him. And that is living outside of campus, right? So I wanted to play on this idea that, like, these two worlds are somehow colliding, and yet at the same time, the center of gravity is still, like, this college campus, because, you know, to a lot of people who, you know, make it into an elite university like that, to a lot of Black youth to make it to elite university like that, you know, there's an honor, there's a prestige that comes with it. But at the same time, there's also an immense amount of pressure, because you're also wondering, like, okay, how is it that I'm here? What am I supposed to do now that I'm here? What does the future look like? And the character himself, actually, TJ, in the story, is based off of a handful of friends of mine in college who I know have shared their own struggles with me and their own challenges navigating college. What I like to compare the film in contrast to, actually, is a big source of inspiration for the film was Good Will Hunting, you know, with Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, the classic, you know, it's a classic film shot in the 90s, right? And it's about, you know, we all know the story about how it's the kid who's in the janitor who solves the, you know, math equations on the board at MIT, and the professor hunts him down so he can be his protege, right?
Right.
And something in this film that I want to do, that I was doing in this film, that kind of that was drawing from that film, was that, you know, Black genius exists. You know, Black and brown genius exists. And we don't see stories that highlight that. You know, we don't see stories of people of color, you know, out here doing amazing things that will change the world, that have nothing to do with social justice. Like, let's throw social justice away from the conversation of, like, films that are in this, because they're there. We know that they're there. We know that they exist, and we know that there have been people who changed the world in that way. But, like, I really wanted to talk about, like, let's talk about Black and brown people who are changing the world through technology or through science or through education or through, you know, I feel like these are sort of protected and privileged career paths that only certain white folks or model minorities get to pursue. And there's also, like, a certain stereotype of how you behave once you're in that space. You have to sort of adopt kind of personalities of whiteness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the story, TJ, he's like struggling with that. Like, he's struggling with his own identity, because, like, is he supposed to follow this pathway where he just becomes the only Black person working at a tech job? Or is he going to be following this path where he's among people that he belongs with and whom he mutually respects? So there's this conflict that he has in the story. And more importantly, though, it's really about bending the stereotype of what it means to be a genius, because I think the problem that I see in a lot of films today is that genius is only reserved for white men, and that's something that I just really want to dismantle and shatter, one film at a time.
I'm thinking of the first short that I saw of you, and I apologize, I should have had this prepared, but the name escapes me. But
Street Battle.
Street Battle. Can you describe the?
So that was more of a comedic film. So the finals was the film I was just describing, is more of like a thriller. It's sort of a crime thriller, coming of age crime thriller. Street Battle, though, is a kind of a comedy. It was a really subtle comedy. So in the story, it's basically about So the same actors in both films, actually. My friend Justin Williams, he's based out of Los Angeles. What's up, Justin? Hope he gets to watch this. So Justin, his name is Tony. So Tony, played by Justin Williams in Street Battle, he just got off work. I mean, it's kind of a day in a life type story. He just got off work. He has to pick up his daughter from school or for someplace. And on the way there, you know, he picks up some snacks to bring her from the liquor store, and he gets a call from his baby mama. But on the way there, though, so we never see his daughter, but on the way there, he's blasting his music out of his car, which, you know, we all love to do. And it just, you know, it's like a liberating feeling. And I wanted to play on this idea that, like, you know, what happens if there's someone else that wants to play their music as much, they love their music as much as you love your music, right? And that too is actually based on my own experience, because, like, you know, in Oakland, like, everyone loves their music. We love our music here. And, like, you drive around, people are just blasting music out their cars, right? And there's been so many times where, like, I'm blasting my music out my car, and someone else is blasting their music out their car. And we're just, like, giving each other looks like, oh, man, come on, man. Like, turn that down. I'm going to turn mine up, right? So in the story, so TJ, he's like, oh, sorry, Tony, he leaves the liquor store. And there's really no music at all through the scene until he turns his stereo up. He gets to a stoplight, and then someone else pulls up next to him. And, you know, there's kind of like this tension already that exists. You know, I think in a lot of films, you think of like films like Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society, even like comedies like Friday, you know, there's a lot of stereotyping done where there's like this expectation of violence anytime you see two black figures, two black characters, two black or brown figures side by side, right? Who have an equally powerful presence on film, right? And when I show it to a lot of people are like, oh man, it's gonna be a drive-by. And no, actually, what ends up happening is, like, so TJ in the story, like, they both just gradually turn up the knobs on both their music, and it sounds like the subwoofers in the back of their car are about to burst. But then TJ doesn't realize it, but that his playlist is on random, and it skips to his daughter's nursery song, you know, playing a toddler song. So he gets embarrassed, you know, he like kind of loses quote unquote street credibility among this other guy who's like just like laughs at him like, hey dude, like, that's a whack song, like, he just drives off laughing, right? So I really wanted to play with that expectation of violence that I often see as a toxic stereotype in a lot of films, especially coming of age films that depict black and brown youth, and I just wanted to focus on something that was just more day in the life and just made someone laugh at the end. So that's kind of where that came from.
Yeah, I think in Street Battle, I remember very much that moment of tension that is like heightened when, you know, I mean, we've done a horrible job of representing young black people in film. Like, how can it be that we see two cars pull up next to each other and two people of color looking at each other, and automatically there's a feeling that there's going to be, that something awful is going to happen?
Yeah,
I thought you played into that extremely brilliantly, and it feels like it's like commentary without anything being said.
Thank you for that. And that's something that there's a lot of subtlety that I think if you're outside those spaces, if you don't have like black friends, if you don't have black and brown friends, if you don't like listen to, if you don't live within the culture that I think a lot of youth aspire to live into when they're like in middle school and high school going into college, there's this automatic perception that I think that culture should be accompanied by violence. And it's so messed up to me, because like that's the reason why there end up being a lot of social problems that get associated with those images and those stereotypes. And it really starts with film, because, you know, There are white people out there who've never even met a black person or a brown person in real life. So their only knowledge of what it means to be black or brown is through a film, a movie that they saw, right? And it's like we have no control of what you know, narratives are being, you know, spewed into those minds of people who just, they don't know. They just don't know. So like, yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Because it's challenging. Like, it's challenging because there's a lot of subtlety, and that subtlety I think is missing in a lot of narratives where they just insert their token person into the film, and you know, that token person ends up being, you know, almost too predictable in a way. And I wanted to make this less predictable.
Yeah, no, I really appreciated that. I want to definitely talk a little bit more about the industry and where we see kind of the root of these issues. I mean, you said it yourself, it starts with film, but you know, the film doesn't like exist in a bubble. Like there are people who have created the environment to allow these films and these characters and these stereotypes to thrive. And I want to get into that a little bit more later. But I want to also bring Celeste into the conversation. Celeste, you've spent most of your life surrounded by and talking about film and watching film. I can only imagine how much film that you've watched in your lifetime. Can you talk a little bit about how you have come to an understanding or assessment of the importance of representation in film? You know, we're talking about Blackness, we're talking about people of color. When you were younger, did you see yourself reflected in the contents you were exposed to watching as many movies as you likely did?
Yeah, and I just want to say everything you were saying, Nathan, is so fascinating. And I think just like so spot on. I feel like representation, the way we talk about it, it does have to carry this huge importance because it's everything, seeing yourself and represented and seeing the possibilities for yourself, but also just like for learning how to empathize and sympathize with others who don't look like you. And so for me growing up, I mean, I'm biracial, I'm half Chinese American. The other half of me is French, white French. And so, you know, I never really saw like families that looked like mine. I didn't see a lot of Asian American representation on film or on TV, barely ever. You know, there was like a Power Ranger here or there, or you know, every once in a while there's a friend character or something like that. So I did always really cling to those very, very dearly. But like you both were talking about before, sometimes those characters are created with these harmful stereotypes that just when you're growing up, you don't have all the language and all the context to realize what all that means and why you might feel a certain way about it. And then later when you're older, how that actually influenced you. So I feel like I've been doing most of my sort of soul searching on that really recently, like in the last, you know, 5-10 years when I've had more of a language to interrogate that and talk about that. So, but the flip side of that is that I did grow up in a very like cinephile family, and my mom's dad was a director. So I did always grow up knowing that this industry existed and was something that was accessible. You know, when I was growing up, I didn't think, oh, he's a white man, so that's not something I could achieve. I didn't really like think in those terms. I just thought, yeah, you can make a movie that's sort of loosely based on your childhood and people will respond to it. And then there you go. So I was really lucky in that sense and very privileged to have that sort of accessibility into it. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of Asian American representation, there really wasn't that much. In the last few years, there's so much more. We have a long way to go, but there's a lot more, and it's incredibly meaningful. And especially in terms of coming of age films, I loved what you said, Shakira, at the beginning about how painful that time can be and how raw it is, because it is. And I am actually really drawn to those stories now because I feel like I am still sort of processing that time in my life. And I like to see it depicted honestly, which is so rare, that I am really drawn to those stories. And so I'm thankful that there is work being done and there are more available to me now. But at the time growing up, it didn't feel like there were a lot. Yeah. And to Nathan's point about how white people, and I'll say like non-Black people, don't see Black stories in coming-of-age films that are authentic. I think that's just such a huge part of it, because people of color, kids of color, will always see white coming-of-age narratives. They're just, it's never going to be underrepresented. It's never going to be a marginalized group. They're always going to see those stories. And so they're always going to build empathy and sympathy for white kids and those kinds of stories. But the opposite is not true yet.
I think that, like, really dissecting what a coming of age narrative or documentary actually holds. I was thinking about this as you were speaking, Celeste, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that, like, kids fuck up, right? They're going through something really difficult, they fuck up, and then there's like this space of forgiveness. And I guess I hadn't really thought about that when you were talking about building empathy for mostly white characters. You then mostly see in the coming of age, white characters fucking up and then being given the space to, you know, do better or to receive forgiveness in the story. And I was just thinking about, that is also something that, you know, thinking deeply about that feels traumatic, like not being able to see Black character receive not just a representation, but kind of like receiving that same care of like growing up, being able to make mistakes, and just having it usually being rooted in themes that are just like really decidedly like negative. Do you guys have any thoughts about that specifically?
Yeah, I mean, like it eats at your morale, because when I think about, you know, when I was in middle school, or when, you know, all my friends in middle school, the things that we aspire to become, right? That's really what it comes down to, because when you're given such a small margin of error and you only have such narrow career paths given to you, there's something revolutionary in the idea that actually there are infinitely many paths you can go. Like, you don't have to fall into the stereotype of a career that is bestowed or is depicted in the stories you watch, right? Mm. Like, you don't have to be a basketball player. You don't have to be in sports. You don't have to be a drug dealer. You don't have to, you know, be stuck in the hood. You don't have to be following along some kind of career that your dad did before you, right? So it just eats at your morale to whenever you watch these stories where, one, the white kid is excelling like almost exponentially, and two, the Black kid or the brown kid is just struggling and where the story ends up being about him just simply overcoming the struggle through survival. Mm-hmm. Where that's not enough. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's the whole Maya Angelou, it's not enough to survive. Like, we want to see people thriving, right? And that's what's frustrating. It's like, it's so frustrating seeing that. Like, I want to see like people doing dope shit and kicking ass, like outside of their individual personal traumas, right? Like, you know, we can make a story, you know, like even in Good Will Hunting, for instance, you know, Matt Damon, he like grew up in a supposedly poor area of Boston, and that ends up being the background, but, you know, it doesn't end up being all about that. And, you know, in that story, you know, he has his own personal traumas in the same way that those exist for a lot of other films. Like, for instance, Dope by Rick Famuyiwa, starring Shameik Moore. You know, in that story, you know, he's in high school, and it's kind of similar in the sense that in Dope, Shameik Moore's character, he grows up in Inglewood, and he has dreams of going to Harvard, right? And throughout the story, you get a sense of, wow, this kid is precocious. He's like, he's just an intelligent guy, and it's like, yeah, he should fucking get into Harvard. But mm-hmm. like, he has like this thing, like he has the backdrop of the society that he's in Inglewood, California, that in some senses feels like it holds him down, right? What's interesting though in this story is that, like, what I love about that story specifically is that we see how he like excels and how he can excel in both areas in life. He can excel in like him being a kid from Inglewood, but then using that same intelligence to apply it towards filling out a college application and writing an application in a way that's like speaks to his own personal identity outside of just being a Black kid from Inglewood, right? Mm-hmm. So that's something that to me, I think is missing a lot. And it just hurts. Yeah, it just hurts to always see the white kid, always get the gold medals, always get into Harvard, always get, you know, there's like this presumption or almost entitlement in film that, oh yeah, the white kid who's like a valedictorian should get into Harvard. Right. Well, what about the Black kid who's a valedictorian? There should be that same amount of presumption built into that character. And because it's missing in Hollywood, you know, Hollywood has a lot of work to do to catch up to the fact that not all kids who are in middle school and high school have dreams outside of being basketball players or athletes or, you know, sort of cut from the same cloth type careers, right? And yeah, that's really what it comes down to.
I want to talk about the Institute. But before I do that, Celeste, I was just thinking, you know, how Nathan is framing his perspective as a filmmaker. You and I have a lot of conversations about this at work. And when we're, you know, we're watching films and then like, there's almost this like really, and I don't know if white people experience this, but there's almost this really inherent, like, feeling that you get when you're watching a story that you like automatically already know if the filmmakers are white or are if they're people of color, right? Can you talk about that just briefly from your experience as a curator, a programmer?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's so funny to put it that way. yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this in a lot of different ways. I mean, I think you and I both feel this, and you mentioned this in your opening, this responsibility to amplify stories of marginalized groups and to really emphasize that. And I think, there's this sort of trap we can sometimes fall into when we just talk about representation as sort of like a superficial face value thing. And then when you go a little bit deeper, we start to talk about who is telling the stories, who gets the resources and the opportunities to tell those stories, and, you know, where they're coming from, if it's from a place of authenticity or not. And then also the business side of it is like, which filmmakers do, you know, as a festival, you're giving them an opportunity, you're putting them on a platform, and they're also giving you an opportunity too, of course, it goes both ways, but, you know, you're sort of putting your stamp of approval on it and hopefully helping a filmmaker's career. So it really has like many layers of possible impact. Mm-hmm. And so we can't really think about one without thinking about the other, I think. And the other thing is, I love hearing you talk about from your perspective of education, because I think that kids and teenagers are often kind of like not always like fully respected as an audience, and people don't think that they have the capabilities of noticing when something's not authentic or not. And they, of course, completely do, sometimes probably better than adults do. So I think that's a really important perspective, too, of just like really respecting your audience and knowing that they'll know when something is authentic and when something's meaningful to them.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to read this statement that I actually still have saved in my story highlights from when I was working at a major film festival. Whatever, fuck it, I was at Sundance. And I was extremely frustrated. You know, when you, I say this a lot, that I personally, when I got started in film, you know, I came from education. I used to be a history teacher. And when I got started in film, I thought that this was going to be a way to, you know, have that social impact and create that change by using film as a medium. And so when you look at like the upper echelons of these organizations that, you know, the most brilliant people in the industry are working, and then you get there and then you realize nobody is doing the work, you know, that people should be doing to actually be authentic about that social change and to use the power of film to its greater effectiveness. You know, I've been in some spaces where I was like, oh, this is where people are really doing the work and having these conversations, just to find out that I've been, you know, more disappointed by the Institute than I have just by like talking to regular people on the street about anti-racism and about racism and about the responsibility of the arts. So I wrote this when I was a little angry. You can probably hear it in the tone. I should be sleeping, but I'm thinking about the ways arts institutions mimic and export culture through programming objectives. Pumping sanitized homogenous whiteness into individual regional communities and the ways it's designed to keep all comfortable. Comfortable audiences, comfortable donors, comfortable boards. And I'm complicit in my desire to promote independent thinking through film, the liberation of young Black minds through cinematic arts, and documentaries as our number one tool for social change. I rely on the platforms given to me by these institutions of white wealth. So I want to kind of, I want to briefly discuss where, you know, I know we're not going to be able to come to a solution, but I can in certain parts identify where the problem is. Mm-hmm. And it's not just one specific thing. Nathan, maybe from your perspective as a filmmaker, why are institutions not changing? And Celeste, from your perspective as, you know, of course, your experience in film as a programmer and an audience member. And Nathan, would you like to start?
Yeah, you know, there's a sense that there is change. And the question is, well, how fast or slow is that change happening in these institutions? Because we could talk about the institutions of film, you know, the industries, the investors, the production companies that really do dictate images and imagery and representation. And then there's also, you know, you can extend, those all seep into other institutions like government, like businesses and corporations. And it really plays into, you know, like I want to make a distinction because there's like white supremacy and there's like whiteness, right? And mm-hmm. I think most white people, I mean, maybe pre-2016, I don't know about these days in the United States, but most white people don't want to be labeled a white supremacist, right? Now, whiteness, however, is something that, you know, if you ask someone, well, do you subscribe to whiteness? I think oftentimes, especially with the people who are outside these conversations, they want to know what that is. Like, what is whiteness even? Because, you know, if you are white, then all you see is whiteness and you're sort of blind to things that are non-white or anything mm-hmm. that's different or maybe mm-hmm. makes you uncomfortable or even threatening might be perceived as non-white, right? So there's like this strange, like, I just want to call it the comfort bubble. Like, whiteness is like this cozy blanket that you get to wear and feel good about yourself, you know, and it's the Prius that they drive to work and or whatever to pick up their $8 latte on the way to their six-figure job, right? And to be able to come home with in absolute safety, you know, that's whiteness. You know, another example is, you know, I used to work at I had this job in San Francisco, and it was like a 140,000 square foot office. It was huge. It's a huge office, right? And a lot of companies like to do this. A lot of companies like to have conference rooms with themes, right? So like some people like to have conference rooms where the theme is like location. So it's like different cities, like Paris, the Paris room, the Tokyo room, the London, New York room, so on and so forth, right? So the theme of this particular office was scientists, right? So there was like a Galileo room, There was like a Newton, you know, an Isaac Newton room. There was like an Albert Einstein room, right? So you can get the idea. One day I just decided to like walk around the entire office, right? Just to see like whose names were on all these conference rooms, right? And through every single conference room was named after a white person. Mm-hmm. You know, there was like, I think maybe one woman, there's like Marie Curie who was in one of the conference rooms. But you know, like if you are non-white, right? And you walked into that space and you look at all these conference rooms of, you know, people who have, you know, if you look in terms of history, have made significant contributions to scientific achievement. You know, if you're a black person or a brown person in that space, you're kind of just asking like, well, what about the achievements like my ancestors have made, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because I think we all have contributions to make to these institutions, and there's almost like a sense of paranoia where like, well, we know we've made contributions, but like people want to steal that from us or take that from us or take credit themselves for something we've done. You know, I used to have a manager one time who would like, I would come up with ideas and then he would take credit for them in meetings. Right. You know, so it's like, and you know, he's a white dude, you know, so, and that's what whiteness is really. It operates on this much more subtle level, right? There's a lot of nuance to it. It's not outwardly racist, but it definitely eats at, I think, what our individual capacities are in individuals as BIPOC people to just social contribution. Because I think there's so many people like, and this really is a message to like, you know, the kid in eighth grade who wants to study to be a computer scientist, or, you know, the seventh grade black girl who wants to become an epidemiologist. And imagines herself wearing like a lab coat and that being her idea of what a heroine is, right? That they exist, number one, and two, that those contributions with the right environment and with the right attention to, I think, our own individual paths and who we are as people has this capacity to unleash greatness, right? And that's what it comes down to. It's really like honing in. You know, whiteness really is a way of kind of, I think, subduing our greatness. Mm. And once you peel that falsity, that kind of veneer off these social structures and these institutions, there's so much to celebrate and to achieve. So much to celebrate and so much to like champion and so much to admire in terms of achievement. And it's not just achievement outside of politics and social justice. It's achievement inside of other career paths and other sectors as well. And I think right now, you know, I've been thinking a lot on, and this is to some extent, like after Black Panther, you know, themes of Afrofuturism, or even themes of what I like to call like tribal futurism, where we're like leaning on tribal knowledge that extends like generations back. And now we're sort of reinventing that, bricolage, you know, there's kind of like an element of bricolage where we're taking like other elements of the modern world and taking tribal or indigenous knowledge and turning it into something new and fresh and modern, contemporary, technologically savvy, right? There's definitely a need from a lot of conversations I've had, you know, with filmmakers and cinephiles, like Black filmmakers, Black cinephiles, people of color who want to see, for instance, like science fiction told from the lens of individual Black contributors, right? Mm-hmm. And that being a means through film of overcoming some of these constraints that whiteness imposes on us as creatives. You know, so like, you know, we were just talking, I was talking to my friend Roxanne yesterday. You know, she's a Black queer woman, and we were talking about Antebellum, right, with Janelle Monáe, directed and written by Gerard Butch and Christopher Renz, right? And we all thought that there was going to be like a time travel scene. We thought like she was going to be like doing some kind of sort of time travel between the past and present and future, and we didn't get that. And we were talking about how, oh, man, that would have been so dope. Like, but and then how come we start asking ourselves, well, how can we never see like Black time travelers, right? Mm. You know, even, you know, you think of H.G. Wells, I think it's H.G. Wells, right, who wrote Time Machine, right? You see a lot of these characters who are, the people who are afforded somehow the luxury to be able to do things like time travel or to be able to use some like new powerful invention, they're never people of color. And so I think that's missing a lot in film. I also think there's a demand for that. I think, like, you know, I think there's business value. If you're a production company, there are audiences who are like starving to have images of that because they know they exist and they know it's needed. I can keep on talking about this forever, but like, I know that's something that comes to mind immediately is like science fiction, I think, is a way of, you know, dismantling whiteness, because science fiction I've seen tends to be something that becomes the most reserved and entitled for white men. And I think the more Black and brown people, Black and brown writers, actors, creatives, you know, owning and claiming, you know, that genre, and not just that genre. I mean, it's something that speaks to me a lot, and it's something that I know a lot of people want to see, but I think it's a genre that I think, you know, just name one Black sci-fi filmmaker, right? You know, like, look at all the sci-fi movies Steven Spielberg has made. We don't need another, like, sci-fi, you know, we don't need another, who's the new hot kid on the block? The guy who wrote Devs, you know, we don't need Alex Garland, right? I mean, it's a good movie, but it's like, you know, there's enough of those. There are enough stories, I think, already that are like that. And so I think that genre, I think once we start to see that genre claimed, owned, and, modified in a way that belongs to us, I think that's when we'll start to see true greatness in film, I think. And not to say that there hasn't been greatness in film, there has, you know, it's like, but like, if you're not John Singleton, if you're not Spike Lee, you know, there's other films that you can be making. And maybe you don't want to write another, you know, Do the Right Thing or Boys in the Hood story. Maybe you want to write about a Black time traveler or a computer hacker who, like, you know, ends up making a bunch of, you know, computer science inventions in a laboratory someplace and wins a Nobel Prize. Like, let's see films like that, you know?
I really love the idea of using science fiction to, like, open up the realm of possibilities, of like the Overton window of seeing what else could be, what else could be possible. Because, like, yeah, the white imagination doesn't have a lot reserved for us, specifically when it comes to entertainment. Yeah, I love that. Celeste, do you want to talk about why our industry is fucked?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to that any better than Nathan did. That was, like, amazing. and I totally agree, and I'm really excited for everything to come. But
what do you see as a curator? Where do you see the problem?
Yeah, I will say that one thing that I do hear kind of, like, over and over again is from the sort of white stakeholders and gatekeepers is that you know, they're just selecting from the pool that they have, and that those films that represent or that showcase non-white people in that authentic way don't exist, or that they don't, you know, they don't come across their table, so they might as well not exist. And I just really want to challenge that notion, because there are so many filmmakers out there that are making these films, and they are just making them out of pure passion and love and a desire to, you know, showcase their art and work on their own, hone their skills, but also because they realize the importance of seeing those films and the ones that they didn't get to see. And so when kind of an offhanded comment can be made that erases all of that art and those filmmakers, it's really upsetting. And it really is telling, I think, of the sort of mindset behind it. And all you have to do is just, like, put in some effort, look a little bit further than you usually would if that's not the space that you occupy. And you can find incredible filmmakers that are doing so much with so few resources because they don't get the resources that they need. You know, here in the US, they don't really get government assistance for films the way they might do in some other countries. So it really is just all about filmmakers that make films out of passion are undervalued at every step of the way. They don't get the investments. They don't get the, you know, marketing budget, the distribution, but they make them anyway and they bring them out into the world. So we can find those and we can help to elevate them. And that would in turn, of course, help us immensely. So I just want to dispel of that notion that they don't exist. They are there. There's amazing filmmakers out there making stories of Black.
Oh yeah, they certainly exist. And if it's okay, if I can, since we're all sort of, we're a Bay Area tribe right here, I do want to put two filmmakers on everyone's radar. One filmmaker by the name of Benjamin Michel. He's originally from the East Coast, Haitian roots. He's currently based out of Oakland. He wrote this film called. He wrote and directed the film called The Slow Burn. And it's about a Black mechanic who teaches himself quantum physics and writes a manuscript, writes a paper, and submits it to an international publication, right? Meanwhile, his girlfriend is Asian. And his mother, you know, has kind of, you know, there's a sense of he has to fight for this Asian mother's approval that he's good enough for his daughter. And his daughter is like trying to prove to his mother that he's more than just a mechanic. He's actually this genius physicist. And the story basically is about his internal conflict, kind of resolving these tensions, both within himself as like a mechanic and as a quantum mechanic physicist, but also as, you know, himself and a boyfriend to this person that he really loves. So Benjamin Michel, The Slow Burn. I hope people can check it out. It was we played it at the Fruitvale Film Series this year. Another filmmaker who by the name of Morgan Matthews, also based in the Bay Area. He's originally from Atlanta. He lived in Oakland for some time. I think he still lives in Oakland. And he's working right now on an episodic series called Bit. And Bit is Bit, B-I-T. With a period, by the way, B-I-T period. It's a dark comedy that sort of speaks to the underbelly of what it's like to work in Silicon Valley as a person of color. And it's from the perspective of these two Black entrepreneurs and technologists who have the startup idea, and they're constantly battling with the idea that, you know, becoming a startup millionaire, billionaire, whatever is only reserved for a certain, you know, kind of person, right? And it has so much social commentary on what it means to, you know, peel away layers of whiteness. And yes, I encourage everyone, like, hopefully, I know he's in talks right now with a lot of production companies. So I'm wishing Morgan Matthews the best. I'm wishing Benjamin Michel the best. And I'm hoping they stay on everyone's radar in terms of curation, because they have some talent and they have some really amazing stories to tell.
Thank you, Nathan. Celeste, do you think programmers are lazy? Or are they just too comfortable? You know, the gods of our industry, of the film festival world, So this is part of where I see the problem lies. I don't see programmers taking up the responsibility of educating an audience. I think the idea of neutrality is based in white supremacy. And I think programmers and curators lean into that. I don't think it's helpful for the culture. I don't think it's helpful to bring new audiences to independent film. So is it laziness, or is it comfortability, or is it just straight up like racism? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be all of those things. I don't think those are necessarily like separate buckets. You know, if the end result and the impact is racist harm, then that's what it is, you know, and we should call it that. I think a lot of it is rooted in just the sort of like tradition of it, or like, you know, the sort of, this is how it's always been sort of excuse, or not that they even would think of it as an excuse, but that's just sort of like where they're so deeply rooted. And you're right, it's where they're comfortable. So that is a big part of it, stepping out of that space where you're not comfortable, maybe allowing room for other voices that may have different expertise in those fields would help a lot. You know, if certain programmers are sort of struggling to figure out how they even begin because they don't know that world or whatever, you know, it can take a lot off their shoulders if they just like ask someone for help. But that of course takes like the, you know, you have to kind of like let go of your ego and realize that.
Oh shit. Programmers and ego? Stop. You know, I think also like part of the problem, and then I'm gonna kind of wrap this portion up. I wanna read one statement before going into who is getting it right. I've asked each of you to pick a narrative or a documentary that you think is doing the work. But before that, you know, stating that I think when we talk about the Institute and when we talk about community outreach, is this, you know, shining beacon that most of our organizations receive a lot of grant funding through community outreach and education. I think a lot of the problem is white people being in positions of power when it comes to community outreach and education. Not that those roles should be reserved for people of color, like they couldn't be EDs or they, you know, couldn't be programmers. But I think it's extremely problematic when, you know, you as an organization are professing to be inclusive and promote culture and promote diversity in the arts, and the people who are directly responsible for talking to the community are white and have no idea what they're doing wrong. That's something that I've seen in the organizations I've worked for and, you know, worked around. So, you know, that's something to think about. I have kind of a statement that kind of talks about the other side of the coin. We've talked a little bit about how Black narratives are usually rooted in trauma and how that's problematic, specifically for students to not be able to see other sides of themselves reflected back to them. I was gonna have a conversation about this, but I think we're gonna start wrapping this up. So I'm just gonna read the statement and then maybe folks can give this some thought. Nijla Moomin wrote an article that states, "Stop saying there are no coming of age films about Black girls." Nijla wrote Jin, and I'm gonna read this statement here. It resonated with me in the conversation. Start of the quote, "Black joy historically has not been seen as profitable, meaning the Black joy that emanates from real deep places, not from caricature or stereotype. Black joy in the sense of Black girls laughing, riding a bike, braiding their hair, reading a comic book, and falling in love. But Black joy can also exist alongside pain, discomfort, confusion, or distress. And I don't think one necessarily negates the other. We're not here to sanitize the experiences of teenagers. As artists, we should strive to represent the truth and complexity of their lives or any life that we render on screen. Being a teenager is inherently traumatic. I don't know many people who got through adolescence unscathed. I still remember sitting in a subway in Richmond, California, when a boy I developed deep feelings for told me he had a girlfriend shortly after we'd been to prom together. It was earth-shattering for me. It was my first heartbreak, and I can still recall the pain of that experience very clearly. Or the time an intense, fiery argument with a best friend left me in tears and shaken. I remember it was raining, and I felt like I'd lost a part of myself. These experiences were traumatic in a sense that they forced me to see the world around me in new, painful ways. They colored my perception of certain experiences. I knew the feeling, the taste, the pain of loss. They had nothing to do with poverty or survival, but if they had, would that make them any less valid in this discussion? So let's get to who, a segment that I have decided to call Who Got It Right. So each of us name a film we feel did justice in representing Black joy and Black voices authentically. Celeste, would you like to start the name of your film? Maybe if you have it available, who directed it, in a short description and why this was meaningful?
Yeah, sure. I think that quote actually goes beautifully with this. I wanted to talk about Pariah by Dee Reese. So it was her first feature film, which came out in 2011. And it was based on a short film that she made. The way she talks about it, it's semi-autobiographical. And it follows Alike, who is a teenager and a poet, and she is navigating how to come out as a lesbian to her family. She's out to her best friend, who is also out, and she is also navigating like an intense crush and first love with another girl. So I just have really strong memory of first seeing this film. It premiered at Sundance that year. And I think as someone who was, I was in college at the time and was just discovering what kind of films I was into and spoke to me. And so I had heard so much about it and finally watched it when it was available. And I just think it's so authentic. It's so specific that it becomes incredibly relatable. And it's definitely a drama. I mean, there's definitely some painful moments in it and exploration of the pain of having parents that aren't ready to fully accept you yet. And there is some, you know, some trauma associated with that, but it does such a good job of just showing her complete world. And so the joy and the playfulness with her best friend and the, you know, deep, raw emotional connection with the girl that she is falling for. And then also her passion for her writing. And as she's discovering, you know, what she's good at and an outlet for her to express herself well, and how that can open up possibilities for her beyond this high school experience that is so, you know, painful and difficult. And I just love it in the context of this conversation. Dee Reese talks about how she didn't really see any teenagers that were out and comfortable being like butch lesbians until she moved to New York when she was in her 20s. And she just, you know, like saw them walking around her neighborhood. And that led to the inspiration for her making this film. And so it's just like a perfect example of how important representation is. So whether it's seeing someone on the street, if you happen to live in a place that's diverse, or now, thanks to her and others, people don't have to move to New York to see that representation. They can see her film and they can see what's possible, because she didn't know that that was even possible until she saw it. And that's how we all experience what is possible for us. So that's my recommendation.
Great. Thank you, Celeste. Nathan, who did it right? Who got it right?
Yeah. So, okay. So I already mentioned Rick Famuyiwa's 2015 film Dope. I think he got it right. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, I think, got it right. Also, for whatever reason, I guess I'm really into films with Shameik Moore. but, you know, I was going to comment on those two films, but I think just in this last 15 minutes of conversation, the one film that I think that really got it right, and got it right in a way that they didn't need to live in the Marvel comic universe, and they didn't need to, and they didn't focus on a Black male, they actually put a Black woman and girl on spotlight, was Channing Godfrey Peoples' Miss Juneteenth. Which also I think premiered at Sundance this year as well. Highly recommend it. It was really amazing about that story, and where I connect to it a lot is, you know, I grew up, like I mentioned, in Houston, in Texas, and, you know, Juneteenth is something that's celebrated every year. And I think only this year has it kind of gained more national prominence in terms of its importance and significance to Black Americans. And what's in the story, you know, there's two main characters, Turquoise Jones, who participated in like the Miss Juneteenth pageant played by Nicole Beharie, and her daughter Kai. So Kai is like in high school. Turquoise, she's already an adult and she has a full-time job as a working mother. What I love about it in terms of a coming of age story is that, you know, you see Kai go through a lot of the same challenges that, you know, I went through in high school and that I'm sure like my girlfriend at the time probably went to. And, you know, you see a lot of that raw pain and joy that comes with just being a high school kid. And being a high school kid who's somewhat living under her mother's shadow, who's trying to find her own identity of herself and express that in the most authentic way possible. And you know to some extent that her and her daughter are the protagonists in the film, but you don't know how exactly they end up winning, so to speak, in the story. But because it's like in this backdrop, I think, of being in Texas, like one, you don't see a lot of films that are even based out of Texas or even in the South, unless they're, you know, quote unquote, antebellum period pieces, which there are plenty of and enough of already, or civil rights pieces, maybe. What I liked about this story was that it was a contemporary backdrop. It was something that, you know, a lot of my friends who, after they watched it, like really connected with a lot. And it's definitely something that I know more people want to see. So, you know, to all the programmers out there, you know, one, watch that movie if you haven't yet. And two, find films just like it. Find films, because they're out there. Like I already named two filmmakers like 30 minutes ago who you can check out, right? So they're definitely there. And in terms of coming of age stories, like there just needs to be more of them, right? There just needs to be more stories that speak on how much the adolescent mind is undergoing profound changes during that time. And if that adolescent mind doesn't see people like him or herself undergoing struggles that are unique to their own, but outside their race and outside their identity, and not pushing a narrative of trauma that's within their race and within their class, then I think there will be a much more authentic human connection, I think, with the audience and the person that they see on film. So it's so tremendously important to have that, because as we were talking about earlier, you know, the possibilities become constrained at such an impressionable age if what Black and brown youth see are just images of stereotypes that have been peddled to them. And so if we get closer to a point where, you know, coming of age stories speak to these endless possibilities and speak outside of trauma porn and speak outside of, you know, the tropes that white filmmakers have, you know, kind of crammed down our throats and eyes, then we'll get towards more human connection. And I think in the end, that's what film is about. It's really about human connections, connecting with the moving pictures that we see and the sounds and the reverberations of the music that we connect to as an audience with film.
Thank you, Nathan and Celeste. I have my Who Got It Right, and I'm gonna kind of make it brief, but I'm really just obsessed with a documentary called Pahokee. Celeste might be able to speak on my love. I have a giant film poster on my cubicle that, you know, I haven't seen in a few months because we're all working from home. But any chance I get to talk about Pahokee, I do. And I think, Nathan, when you're talking about connection, I love this film. Well, I'll tell you what it's about briefly. It's just a fly on the wall documentary about a group of kids in the south of Florida. The backdrop is an economically depressed area, but that's not really what the film is about. The film is literally just 8 months of students just like living their lives, running for homecoming queen, running for student body president, being in relationships. applying to scholarships. And the way that Patrick Bresnan and Yvette Lucas, who are the directors of this film, just show really just like just everyday movements of these Black students, but like with the joy that I think at times is really like reserved for Black people. Like I think Black people celebrate and talk to each other sometimes in a way that like white people or other cultures just like truly don't understand. And that's like really communicated in this film. And when it comes to the connection, I love this film because even though there are some things that white students may not understand, things happen in this film that every student has gone through. Like just basically the last few months of their high school career, every student can relate to the excitement of going to college or you know, going into the workforce, saying bye to friends and going, like starting a new chapter of your life. So when I screened this for students in Salt Lake City, you know, a wildly different place than the south of Florida, students still had really great questions and appreciated the fact that this movie just showed you know, different cultures, but still remain extremely relatable. So please check out Pahokee if you have the opportunity. All right, y'all. I think this was pretty good. I think we did well. What do you think?
This is great. This is awesome. Like I can still keep talking about stuff, but I know we all have our afternoon work grinds to get to.
Absolutely. No, this is fantastic. I enjoyed being in conversation with you. I knew this was just going to be great. Celeste and Nathan, thank you so much. My name is Shakira Rifos. Find me on Instagram, midnight_marauder_84. And yeah, let us know what you thought of this conversation. Appreciate programmers of color for putting us in touch here, Doc Leipzig, and thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation. Have a good day, guys. Yeah.
Thank you, Shakira. Thank you, Celeste.
Thank you.